Leaders are all around us at all times and in every area of our lives. They motivate. They risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In our Central Texas Leadership Series, KWBU has invited local leaders to talk with people they know who guide and inspire to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, Truel Hyde, Vice Provost for Research at Baylor University. Hosting the conversation is Will May, professor and former dean of Baylor University's School of Music. This conversation was recorded on September 8, 2014.
Welcome to KWBU Central Texas Leadership Series, a radio program series that focuses on leadership in the Waco community and what makes leaders within our community tick. I have in the studio today Truel Hyde, who's the Vice Provost for Research at Baylor, and I'm Will May, former dean of the School of Music here and now professor in the School of Music. Welcome, Truel. It's great to see you today.
It's great to see you again.
The Vice Provost for Research. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with academic terminology, you should know that a provost typically is the chief academic officer for an institution of higher education, and so a vice provost would be somebody who works in that realm of taking care of all the academic side of the house at the university. But a vice provost for research, what does a vice provost for research do?
Well, I'm just hoping you're not the only one asking that, or you are the only one asking that question. I'm not real sure. No. The vice provost for research, or the VP for research, is a normative title at research universities. Basically, the position oversees the Office of Sponsored Programs, technology transfer, intellectual property, industry engagement, compliance, a host of other things. But the short version is what I always tell my people is that we exist as an office solely to serve the faculty. Our job is to provide the infrastructure and support for our faculty to be successful in whatever their particular area of scholarship or research is. So we do those things to hopefully provide them with internal funding opportunities, to provide them with all the appropriate compliance that's required by federal regs, all the other types of things that have to go on sort of behind the scene for them to be successful.
You spring from a background as a scientist, a physicist specifically. Truel has been on the Baylor faculty for 25, 26 years. He's the director of the Center for Space Physics, Astrophysics, and Engineering Research, which we around here shorten to the acronym CASPER, a member of the Department of Physics. And so tell us a little bit, Truel, about in your journey from pre-scientist, maybe even, to through scientist to a director of research, what are the landmarks along the way in your journey?
Yeah, well, my grandfather on my mother's side is a minister, and my uncles on my dad's side are ministers, and my aunts on my dad's side are married to ministers. So my mother and dad actually became the black sheep of the family and went the route of becoming college professors. So I actually simply followed them into the family job, I guess. And in terms of the whole science thing, probably to tell you the truth, in third grade, where I was attending school, they had these videos. And one of the videos, I remember very clearly, there were a series of them, but they weren't very long, maybe 15, 20 minutes. One of the videos was all on what made the sun burn. You know, how did the whole process occur in terms of fusion, et cetera. And I saw that, went home, told my parents that's what I want to do, and pretty much never looked back. So I guess that's how that happened. Now, in terms of becoming the vice provost for research, that's a little bit different animal. And moving into administration was certainly not something that I had actually thought about or was aiming for. It sort of just occurred.
I think that's commonplace for all of us who've had a place in administration. I think one of the maybe dirty little secrets of higher education is that administrators tend to be people who are perhaps good at something else. Mm-hmm. And then they are chosen to move into administration by their peers by showing some sort of leadership quality, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And so, what tipped the scale and moved you from scientist to leader of science?
Yeah, well, early on, actually, I guess it was about the time when we were actually first coming up with Baylor 2012. I was in that conversation in multiple venues, and towards the we'd approached the point where the document was together. It was actually going before the Board of Regents in several months. And I was asked to be on a little bitty – or at a little bitty meeting with the provost and president and a couple of other things, a couple of other people. And we talked about, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff and, you know, being a faculty member at that time and completely unabashed about whatever I said. I just spoke from the heart, said whatever I wanted to say, and didn't think much about it. And then a couple of weeks later, I got – into a different meeting that evidently later turned out to be a follow-up to this meeting. I had no idea what was going on, but they asked me a series of questions. It was Don again and David Jeffrey and some other people, and at that I sort of outlined what has now become the BRIC, the idea of you know, that might be a thing that Baylor ought to think about pursuing. And several days after that, I got a phone call from then Provost Don Smeltikoff, who said, I want you to meet me for coffee. This is in the middle of the day. Meet me for coffee over at the sub. It's in between Pat Neff and Mars McLean, which is where my office was at the time. And, of course, being a faculty member in the middle of the day, I'm thinking, holy smoke, what have I done now? You know, the provost wants to meet me. And so I went over, and after a little, very little bit of small talk, because, you know, Don wasn't big on small talk, he said, well, I want you to be the vice provost for research, which is a new position. And I have to admit, I was flabbergasted. I had not thought about that at all. I had friends in physics, of course, who had gone on to become, provost or presidents, but that just wasn't something that had crossed my mind. And so I asked him to allow me to think about it, pray about it a little bit, and I'd get back to him, and went home and thought about it and prayed about it a little bit. And what I did realize was that, of course, at the time, you know, the goals of 2012 are so lofty, the goals of Pro Futuris are so lofty, that it would at least give me the opportunity to try to help. You know, try to help the faculty, because I was research active and I knew everything that was missing, you know, all the infrastructure that wasn't there for faculty to even be successful in that type of environment. So I knew that at least I could address that issue or maybe some of those issues. And so I called him back and said, okay, I'm willing to do that. And about 3 days later, the Board of Regents passed 2012 and off we went.
Well, research at that time and research in Baylor's history are very different than research at Baylor today. You mentioned the BRIC, that's the Baylor Research and Innovation Collaborative. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But to hearken back in my own experience at Baylor, which goes back both as a dean and as a student here, as does yours, my student days were in the late 60s, undergraduates today would mistake that for the Paleolithic period, perhaps, but it's
pre-cell phone.
it was a time when research in my own discipline was never mentioned. I discovered in graduate school later, away from Baylor, that there was this whole world of research out there in my discipline, which is music education, and fell in love with it, and it became my life's work.
Sure.
After that.
Sure, absolutely.
But at that time at Baylor, that wasn't mentioned. And the iconic faculty during those days were teachers.
Sure.
And they were not only not expected to do research, but their research, as we know it today, was discouraged.
Absolutely.
Iconic faculty like Ann Miller and
absolutely.
Robert Reed and Robert Packard,
Bob Packard, Darden Powers,
All of those folks, even in Ann Miller's case, she was discouraged by the central administration to pursue the doctorate. She didn't need to do that. She was a fine teacher.
Yeah.
And perhaps the fact that she was a woman, too, entered in. But those were old days. And suddenly, at the same time, pretty much, that you were named Vice President for Research, was a time of great change at this institution as far as attitudes about research and about the need for a research agenda for the university. And it was not exactly welcomed with open arms in particular, and among some. And you played an important role in that, at least. And you were on the firing line during that time period. Reflect on that, those days a little bit for us, and the change from what I remember as an undergraduate and what's in place now.
Well, yeah, there's some things that have changed. There's a lot of things that have remained the same. And I have to admit, you know, having lived through that particular era, and it was a bad era. You know, that was probably the darkest time that I can remember being at Baylor. But surprisingly, most of it didn't, you know, it didn't seem to impact me very much. And that's peculiar, given that I was the research person. I don't think, to tell you the truth, that there was that much pushback against research. Baylor had had research, at least in the form of PhDs, since the 50s. So there were people doing research, but it was much more like what you just described, which was, well, if you want to do that, go ahead and do that. But, you know, it's not going to impact your tenure or promotion, or, and we still expect you to do all your classes. It just wasn't that it was counted as part of your workload in many ways. What was, I think, scary to a lot of faculty was that they were very concerned that research not devalue teaching. And, of course, that was something that fortunately Baylor administration did not want to do, they were absolutely against. And so as a result, once the faculty determined that we were still going to expect incoming faculty and existing faculty to be excellent in teaching as well as excellent in research, then, you know, it was a little easier. It was a little easier. But you're right. There's been a tremendous amount of change over the last decade.
You're listening to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Will May, and I'm speaking today with Truel Hyde, who's the Vice Provost for Research at Baylor. Now we've changed a lot, Truel. We have the Central Texas Technology and Research Park, known around here affectionately as the BRIC, or the Baylor Research and Innovation Collaborative, a huge building renovated to for the sole purpose of being an incubator for research. Tell us how that came to fruition.
Yeah, well, again, early on when I was just really getting started and trying to put the pieces into place for the research infrastructure, I was sitting one day in my office thinking about the fact that Baylor historically has always attracted exceptional faculty. You know, we just really do a good job at getting really good faculty to come here. But the vast majority of the young faculty that come here have never written a proposal. And that's not unusual. That's pretty much true of any place. And so as a result, if they're going to be expected to have funding of some sort to receive tenure, and in this case, I'm really talking about the science and science and engineering guys, not the obviously not the philosophy, religion, music, those guys. It's a different, completely different set of standards. But those that are expected to also receive funding, you know, it's kind of hard to do if you don't even know how to write the proposal. And so one of the things I knew would be good for them is if I could establish a place where these faculty could interact with in an interdisciplinary manner with other faculty. So perhaps basically get into a setup where they had partnerships with other faculty from other departments who might have research that overlapped or at least was cooperatively included or involved with the original faculty's research. Then also if I could get them into a situation where there was industry in the building so that perhaps they could meet a partner in industry that might be willing or able to provide them with funding to support their research. Those type of things, and then also international partners in the building so that they could look for collaborations internationally, would surely help their chances of perhaps receiving funding. And so having said that, I started down that path of thinking about it. And at the time, John Lilly was the president. He came back one day and said, well, Hyde, I think I've got a donor for you to give you a building for that crazy idea you've got, at which point he had came up with Clifton Robinson and Bland Cromwell, who so generously provided Baylor with a building and the property that the BRIC is sitting on. And then, of course, you know, Baylor is so strongly supported by the local community, and they were so generous that of the $30 million that it cost to basically put into place what we called phase one of the brick, which was really taking the building to shell and then putting it back together so that it was prepared for you to establish a lab or an office or whatever inside. Of that $30 million, $20 million came from somewhere else other than Baylor. So that's kind of how that started evolving.
It's an amazing dream now coming true. Where does the Enterprise stand today? What's there now? What's going on
now? Yeah, we're doing pretty well. The building proper has a little over 310,000 square feet, somewhere in there. We have two large rooms for meetings and then some breakout space, and those are being used almost continuously by either Baylor or their partners that are in the building or the community. But we also have 167,000 or so of that 300,000 square feet full with all of electrical engineering research is in there. Mechanical research is going in. We have Lee Steele's epidemiology lab. We have Marlon Scully's quantum optics lab. We have all of Casper in there. We have the launch facility, which is the incubator / accelerator that's basically run out of the entrepreneurship program at Hankamer. We've got L3 already in the building. They've now decided to extend their space because of the 20 or so engineers they had in the building. They decided that wasn't enough, so they're going to double their space and they say go to 50. We've got Region 12 and Huckabee Architectural Firm in the building. They're basically building out space that will be specifically for research and STEM outreach for K-12. We've got 45,000 square feet set aside for TSDC for workforce development. They're in the process of working on that to establish a very rapid response team for workforce development for either new industry or startups or whatever else might need that piece of the puzzle. So, you know, overall, I'd say we're going pretty well.
That's an amazingly diverse operation.
It is.
With so many different kinds of enterprises going under the same roof, and I'm sure collaboration springs up in the hallway that you don't even know about.
That's exactly
just because
right.
By placing those kinds of people together. I have a curiosity about the relationship of all those things. And Baylor's very verbal Christian mission. Baylor has, particularly in recent years, made a strong public point that Baylor is an unashamedly Christian institution with Christian ideals, and I think there's a perception among the general public, perhaps, that somehow is counter to science and somehow contrary to scientific notions, and that perception may be shared among the scientific community.
Mm, sure.
I'd like to know what your response to members of the science community is when they say, well, you know, we may be interested in Baylor, but that Christian thing may get in the way of our scientific research.
Yeah. Well, actually, you're exactly right. And in fact, I would say that particular question is really in many ways a subset of a larger question, which Baylor faculty have looked at for a long time, but it's the idea of faith and learning. You know, how do you take faith and learning, integrate them together and into the university setting, especially if you've now decided that what you want is for that university to become very high research in terms of the way Carnegie classifies things. And that's a difficult question. Obviously, as you know, we've had the faculty at Baylor have had multiple discussions about that, some of them a little bit acrimonious. But we really do have many of the world's best in terms of the people who study that as part of their scholarship. So that's a question that we certainly don't have time to go into. But the more specific question that you ask, you know, it is an interesting question in that I think on the internal side, it's settled out pretty well because what Baylor, at least what evolved out of the whole last decade or so, at least in my opinion, is that Baylor's decided that, yes, you know, you ought to be allowed to figure out what you're going to do and how you're going to approach that. So if you're talking about music and literature or religion or philosophy, obviously it's very easy to bring in the scripture and God and all the rest. If you're talking about the sciences, maybe it's not quite as easy. But if you're talking about cosmology in my field and you get all the way to the end and you say, okay, well, there was nothing, no time nor space, and then in one preceded by you know, 37 zeros, there was something that looks much more like a universe than it did nothing. The question then would become, well, if it's a vacuum fluctuation, where did the vacuum fluctuation come from? And I would posit that there are places, other universities, in which you would not be allowed to ask that question, at least not in that particular fashion.
Yes.
So at least in that regard, I think it's a wonderful gift that we have to allow students to come and study with really top-notch scholars in all sorts of fields and yet not have their faith attacked. So let's look at it from the other side, which is, again, as you also mentioned, the other side is much more interesting because part of my job is to represent the university inside the Beltway, inside the funding agencies or meetings. And so as you might expect, I do get that job. Well, how in the world are you doing this Christian thing if you're going to be also supposedly a top-tier research university at some point? And I will admit that early on, about 3 years into the whole 2012 experience, I ended up in a meeting with a prior president of one of the Ivies. He said, you realize, of course, you know, they don't ask questions. They give you a statement and then expect you to react to it. Right. You realize, of course, this isn't going to work. Let me tell you why. And he said, you know, the thing about it is there are so few highly qualified faculty in the pool from which to draw if you're an Ivy League or a West Coast school or somebody that wants to move up, that anytime you put a restriction on that pool, you've automatically lowered your probability of success. And so fortunately, I was, again, as I mentioned, we were 3 years in, so I had a little bit of data to draw from. I said, well, you know, I can understand that if you were talking about a normal Ivy or somebody that's moving up, then okay, maybe I can buy that argument. But what I will tell you is that if instead you say or you provide the opportunity for someone to come to a school in which excellence in teaching is going to be expected, excellence in research is going to be expected, and you're going to be able to do it within a Christian environment, then what my experience has been is that restriction becomes a multiplier, and you attract folk that want desperately to have those three things in one place, and there aren't a lot of places where you can find those three things in one place. And so that's, you know, I think so far that's done us an immense amount of good.
And to those scientific agenda that are associated with volatile social agenda these days, for example, stem cell research and its association with abortion issues and things like that. Where does what's Baylor's stance on those kinds of things?
Yeah, well, I had actually a phone call several years back about there was about to be a vote on the floor of, I guess it was the Texas Congress. I guess it was the House. I can't remember, but I think it was the House. And we got this frantic call from someone who was a member who was also a Baylor grad and who said, you know, exactly that question. Well, there's about to be this vote. What is Baylor's stance? I said, well, of course, as a university, we don't have a stance. But what I can do is I'm assuming what you're asking me is what should a Christian then do at this particular juncture? And so what I said was, what I can tell you is I can provide you with the names of three different faculty members, all of whom are on Baylor campus, are on Baylor faculty, all of whom are wonderful scholars in their field, and all of whom have a very strong opinion on this subject. And each of those opinions is different. And each of them is a wonderful Christian. So why don't you talk to them? And then what that will give you is a very good understanding of the gamut that can be under the Christian umbrella, and you can draw your own conclusion.
And the gamut under the Baylor umbrella.
And the gamut under the Baylor umbrella. That's exactly right.
You've been listening to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series, and we've been honored to have Truel Hyde, the Vice Provost for Research at Baylor University, in the studio today. Truel, I guess I have one final sort of topic to discuss with you, and that is your advice to those people who maybe had that similar experience to your third grade watching the film. Maybe they're a listener out there that is envisioning their future. We all know at the university that individuals in our culture today go through not one profession, but a host of professions in their work career. What kinds of advice do you give to future scientists? What kinds of advice do you give to those people that may envision themselves in leadership role in the sciences?
Yeah, well, I would say there's several things. I mean, the first being you want to get a good education. And, you know, you need to go and you need to work hard and you need to take the classes and you need to really come up with an outstanding education. Now, by that, I don't mean only in a single subject. I'm a strong believer in the whole Renaissance idea. I firmly believe that especially if you're going to be a leader or even a good teacher, that you need to be well-versed in both your subject material but also all sorts of other disciplines. You need to understand what goes on in the world, and so much of that nowadays is interlocking. A lot of the science, if you narrow in on the sciences, a lot of what is interesting, what's actually driving science these days, is at the intersection of disciplines. It's no longer a siloed piece inside one specific discipline. It's where the overlap occurs. Where does the overlap between biology and engineering and physics and environmental science, where does that all, you know, come about when you integrate all of those into one piece? And so that requires people to have a broader education, much more of a liberal arts, perhaps, education. For example, the University Scholars Program at Baylor, which provides you the ability to do or provides students the ability to do a lot of things well. But it also requires a lot of hard work and a lot of interest in what's going on around them. So, you know, I think a good education stands you in good stead no matter where you go.
And I would be remiss and be neglecting my own discipline if I didn't remind our listeners out there that Truel Hyde is a fine musician in his own right, French horn player. And
maybe a long time ago.
and I would argue, and maybe this is the fodder for another interview, but I would argue that musical experience that you had, if nothing else, shaped your being as a human being, and
I would absolutely agree.
Shaped your discipline, yep. And shaped your ability to deal with abstractions. And a whole lot of things that fit right into that framework that you were talking about as a well-educated person.
No, I would absolutely agree. I mean, I can remember very clearly that I worked more quantum mechanics problems at the piano in the middle of the night than I did in the dorm room or in the library, because I'd just get flat stuck. And I'd go play the piano, work on my concerto or whatever, and, oh, that's what that is. So I agree. I think music's a wonderful wonderful field.
Well, we appreciate you very much being here today. You've been listening to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series, a series that focuses on Waco leaders and their contributions to our community. And our guest today has been Truel Hyde, Vice Provost for Research at Baylor University and Director of the Center for Space Physics, Astrophysics, and Engineering Research at Baylor, and I've been your host, Will May, from the Baylor School of Music. Thanks for listening.
This conversation was recorded on September 8th, 2014, in the KWBU studios.